doing a psalm 145, okay? We'll first read the pasuk in Hebrew and then translate to English, okay? Tehillah leDavid, a psalm to David, Aromimcha Elokai HaMelech. I will lift you up, my God, the King. Va'varcha Shimcha li'olam v'ad, and I'll bless your name forever. Pasuk Beis, second verse. B'chol yom, every day avorachecha, every day I will bless you. V'halalah shimcha, and I will praise your name, li'olam v'ad. What are the questions? Is the God is so far above us, we can't even understand him totally. So how can we lift up his God's name? By lifting up, raising God, it means it's raising God in our mind to a higher level than the way we understood him before. Since it is impossible to understand, to know God in any form or manner, so we can only get closer and closer through our knowledge. And therefore we must have constant study and knowledge of God so that we should always be getting closer to God. That's what Aromimcha means. In other words, I should be constantly getting close to God. I mean to lift it up for the public. This means that you should raise God, your knowledge of God in your mind. The knowledge of God in your mind must constantly, Aromimcha means I will raise you. In other words, it's a constant thing. Since you're saying this prayer, you should constantly be raising. In other words, did any of you, King David, he had much more knowledge than we had. He is saying this, I will raise you, you see. Every person could always have more knowledge of God. You can never have total knowledge of God. And so therefore you should constantly be raising your knowledge of God. Is that we know that the purpose of tefillah, of prayer, is to get the, in other words, first we must get to know the ideas of, to know the idea of God, right? To learn, to have knowledge, like we just said, Aromimcha, we should raise God up, okay? But however, then we have to make it a part of us, okay? Now the thing is the reason why you have to pray is because it's contrary to your emotions, okay? So since it's contrary to your emotions, so we should also try to know, to understand the emotionally how we usually look at this and how this idea counteracts that emotion. It's contrary to your emotions. When we say that raising God to a higher level, we mean that we're constantly having new knowledge of God. There was a leader, Gaon. His name was Rav Hai Gaon. And he said he repented every day because every day he had a new idea of God, which he didn't have before, you see. Now, that idea to constantly realize that you don't have the total knowledge of God leaves a certain insecurity. See, most people want the religious emotion. Most people want religion to have a certain security. And that security is I know who God is and I know what God does for me. But however, we have to realize that God is, we can never know God, and therefore we can only get closer and closer as we get more knowledge of him, but we can never have the total knowledge of him. That's an impossibility. So the thing is because of that, it leaves us insecure, because our religious, a lot of purpose of religion is to give us a security, right? And this is an acceptance that one area, there is security in religion, there is security, but you have to know where it is, okay? And here a person has to feel secure in his knowledge in his knowledge of God, but yet he must have the humility, right? The ability to be able to recognize that he doesn't have all of it of God, and he has to constantly be working on raising himself closer to God. The next thing is Elokai HaMelech, okay, my God the King. Now the Ibn Ezra says that the whole psalm, this whole psalm, is based on the idea that God is the King. Okay? So we have to understand what God the King means, and we'll get more knowledge of it as we go along as we go along in the psalm. Okay? That will wait. The second half of the verse says, V'avarach Hashem chol olam v'adna, bless your name forever and ever. What is the difference between Elokai HaMelech, my God, the King, and when we just say your name? What do you mean by your name? What is that? Two aspects of God. There's one aspect of God, how God relates to us. That's Aramimcha. That's Elokai, I'm sorry, I retract. That's Elokai HaMelech. That's my God, the King. The King is how he relates to me. You see, how he deals with me. That's HaMelech. You see? But Shimcha, your name, what do you mean your name? Your name is what I cannot know. You see? It's like the word Kodosh. The word Kodosh, holy, the word holy, Rashi says, means different. See? That just like the Jewish nation is an Am Kodosh, a holy nation, it means that we're different by virtue of the laws that we have. You see? We're different by virtue of the laws. Okay? Now the same thing, God is also holy by virtue that he's different from anything else in the physical world. You see? And since he is so different, it is impossible to know him. So therefore, the only way, there's two things you could know about God. One is what he essentially, his being is not. You cannot know anything about his being except what he is not. And two, you could know how he relates to us, to the physical world and to the people in the world. That you can know. And you must raise yourself in both aspects of God. Why does when it says your name, that's what it means? Because the thing is, see, every term that we use about God represents really how he relates to us. But the word your name, that has to do with your name. Has nothing to do with, like, King, my God. You see? Those are things in a relationship to me. You see? But when we talk about God's name doesn't mean like I give a name John or Joe. Name means the essence, the definition. Like, for instance, when Adam named the animals, it doesn't mean he gave them names like tigers. It means that he was scientifically trying to categorize the animals. You see? So a name shows a certain categorization, the idea. The idea of God, who God is, that we can never know. That's impossible for a human being to know. So there, but the only thing is that study becomes a study of negative, what he is not. You see? Now, of course, that's going to run contrary to every idea we have of God, because on the contrary, we have to remove every positive idea we have of God. We have to say it can't be that, because that is something physical. Any idea that we're going to have is going to be either physical or somehow attached to the physical, abstracted from the physical. Physical quality, you see? So therefore, that's the study of God in the negative part, to remove what he is not, you see? On the other hand, we have a knowledge of God, of how he relates to us. That's the first half, you see? And both of these we must constantly work on developing a clearer idea in what we mean by he's not physical, so it shouldn't move in any idea of physical. And two, on the other hand, we should try and know how God relates to us, and that knowledge will bring us closer to God. We've explained V'avarach Hashem Pana, bless your name. We'll explain that when we come to the second verse, okay? Okay, every day I will bless you, and I will praise your name forever and ever. Ezra says that the two halves of the pasuk are connected. He says, I will bless your name, I will bless your name every day, right, day after day, until I will be a mahalel, a praiser of God, where I constantly praise God, okay, which is greater, a higher level than the blessers of God. In other words, there's a blesser of God and there's a praiser of God, okay? So when you bless God, that you bless God every day until you reach a point where you become a praiser of God. That's the means of becoming a praiser. And the question is, what is he talking about? What is a blesser of God, and what is a praiser of God, and how does one lead to the other? It doesn't make any, you know, I mean, he's using nice words, but we have to fill it in what it means. In other words, even though this verse says the word Shimcha, your name, I think it includes both from the first half, both the two aspects of God that we spoke about, namely what we cannot know about his essence, and two, how God relates to us. I think it accepts both, but then when you relate to both, first you relate to Avaracha, I bless you, God, right? And first I become a blesser of God, and then later, by blessing God, I become a praiser of God. The question is that blessing is usually when you're giving something to somebody, right? Now, how could you give something to God? How could you bless God? How could you give something to God? And so how could you bless God? Yossi said that the difference between a blesser and a praiser is a blesser is where he makes a conscious time to set aside consciously to work on God, consciously to think about God. While Vahala appraiser is a person that it is a part of him. He doesn't have to set aside time, but it becomes a part of him, this idea that he's in constant praise of God. The only thing is what we ask, so what is, then what is Aramimcha, I will raise you. What's the difference between I will raise you and I will bless you, right? Because according to what Yossi is saying, it seems to be the same thing. So the question really is that we have three things here. The question is, what is I will raise you, and then I will bless you, and then I will become a praiser. Okay? That's what it seems to be. So what we have to answer at this point is, how do you bless God? And two, what's the difference between I will raise you and I will bless you? The thing is that there are three stages that two parts of us that the way we relate to God. We get close to God, one is through our knowledge, right? As we have more knowledge of God, that is getting close to God. And two, to get our emotions in line with those ideas, okay? That's really what we said all Tillum is about. Right, that Tillum really is about, it tells ideas of God, doesn't prove it, it just shows the idea of God, and then what you have to do is first you have to understand the idea of God, then you must review the idea, that's why it says, B'chol yom avarachecha, every day I will bless you, every day. You're right, I'll set aside time for prayer every day. I'll go over these ideas, which I studied, which we worked out through discussions. I will say it every single day, until it becomes a part of my emotions, where my emotions will naturally accept these ideas. You see? That is that is what the three things are saying. That one is that I will constantly search for ideas of God. I'll constantly raise God in my mind. Then when I get these ideas of Varcha, I'll go over them in tefillah and prayer and prayer. I'll go over them constantly until they become second nature to me. Progression. The progression is that first I must get knowledge of God. And then after I have the knowledge of God, then I go over these ideas again and again until, thirdly, it becomes a part of my emotions. There are certain people in the Torah that the Gemara talks about that at a certain point they didn't have to pray. Why didn't they have to pray? The reason is because there was one person that used to pray once a month. He needed like a reminder, conscious reminder once a month. But once these ideas become part of your emotions, then there's no reason to do it anymore.
So you don't have to
moreover, the logic constantly. You might have, in other words, once the mind sees it, you don't have to go over the logic, but you must review the results. To affect the emotion, it's enough just to review the results after your mind has seen the first steps. Question is since this very idea is part of prayer, how is this contrary to your emotions? Question is like this. We are saying that the correct way to operate is we have to tell you the correct way to relate to God. Let's say, for instance, you were born from childhood on. All people were born from childhood on to do it naturally. The Psalms have to tell us we have to know how to breathe. Does anybody have to train you to breathe? No, because that you can automatically do correctly. On the contrary, if you don't do it correctly, after a while, they might have to train you. There's certain retraining. Where people have certain problems, they have to retrain them in certain basic things where you did naturally all your life. The only place you have to be trained is where you don't do it correctly. Right? Okay. Right? Now, they are telling us how to relate to God. So, King David says, first what you do is you gain knowledge of God. After you gain the knowledge, then you review it many, many times until it becomes part of your emotions. Right? Now, since they have to tell us this, this is probably not natural. What I would like to know is how naturally do we relate to prayer? Prayers is simply an expression of my emotions. Most people, when they pray because they want to express their emotions, so in the prayer, they just see their emotions. What we're saying is that prayer is not an expression of my emotions, but it's a training to train my emotions. You see? It's the opposite of the way we usually look at prayer.
Yeah.
Also, the purpose, a lot of people pray, it's really some type of a trade-off, where I say nice things about God, and therefore God gives me everything I want. Okay? The truth is, it works the opposite. The prayer, tefillah, prayer, is to really help you after the mind sees the true ideas, you see, then the prayer will help you, you see, then it could, by going over it. The thing is, you see, the proof that really people see prayer as a means just to express my feelings, is do you ever hear of a subject, prayer, where we sit down and study it? You know, do a total analysis on prayer. You never see that. What I'm saying is your emotions is not in line with reality of God. Okay? And therefore, the thing is that the first thing is you must see the truth about God. Who God is and what He is and what we can understand about Him and what we can't understand about Him. Okay? Now, what I'm saying is that after you study, that's our Rome Mimcha, I will raise you, right? Then the second thing is that you must be a blesser of God, meaning that you go over and over and over these ideas until you become a praiser of God, which means that now your emotions are in line with the true ideas of God. But those true ideas come from the mind, from study and from knowledge. And therefore, a study of prayer is a very, you know, very important thing. I think why people have a problem with tefillah, with prayer, is one of the problems is that once you see a person that enjoys ideas and seeing the ideas, I don't think they mind reviewing the ideas if it was in their own way. You know what I mean? Like you talk it over with somebody, you think it over on your own terms and your own ideas. You see, but the problem is that you're forced to do it in a certain way, at a certain time, in the exact words of our sages, you see, and even if you studied it, but to force yourself to be getting to that mode, at that particular moment, in that particular time, three times a day, is a very, very difficult thing. But our sages had to do it that way, or not the whole idea of tefillah would be lost. I mean, if they just left it up to people, I mean, people just wouldn't do it. I mean, if people naturally did it, we wouldn't have to have these things. But the truth is they had no choice. They had to make it an institution of tefillah, of prayer, so that people should really sit down and pray, because that you're obligated from God to pray, or from our sages, which is the same thing, because God gave our sages the right to make laws, and so they made the prayers. You see? But the thing, so that makes it difficult, but they have to do it that way. But the truth is, it should be like the mind should see the results as you go through the verses. It should see the results of these ideas as much as you can. I think there has to be a training how to read the verse, you see, and just have the idea in mind. I mean, it is difficult. At the beginning of one verse will take you a long time. But I think that after a while, as you train yourself and you start realizing it's just a thought and it's just an idea, you know what I mean? So that you put your mind in that framework, that to be able to go across, just to review ideas, to not, I understand it's difficult. You know what I mean? That a lot of people, have this problem. I've spoken to many people. But it's just a matter of training. You have to do it. But at the beginning, it's slow, right? At the beginning, just work out one verse. You see, then later on, you'll get more. Okay? This is, how does asking God, requesting God for things, fit into this idea? So, how does asking God for things fit into this idea of tefillah? Okay? You have to understand that God relates to a person based on the level that the person is. Okay? In other words, God's relationship to Moshe Rabbeinu, to Moses, is very different than his relationship to us. Okay? So, of course, he's closer to Moses than to us. Okay? Now, the thing is that there, in when you ask something of God, see, most of the times, it's a feeling of, I am asking God for something. You see? I become the center, and I want God to give me. But implied in that request, if you could think of it the other way, that the only being that could really answer all your requests is God, that alone is bringing you closer to God. Because you're making a part of you. See, most of the times you don't think of the giver. You see, in other words, when you start prayer when you're in your youth, you do not think of the giver, you only think in terms of receiving of the self. Now, if you could take one step ahead of yourself, you see, and say it is God that has the power to give. And that idea is also sometimes difficult to recognize, to go over how God gives. Is the whole, I mean, we're not going into the whole problem of that why doesn't God listen to all my prayers? Why does he give me sometimes? Why doesn't he give me? That in itself is a discussion, you see. I'm just showing you that in itself also just can't be taken superficially, you see. So the thing is, as we get closer to God in these three stages, one, by in my mind knowing new ideas about God. Two, by constantly reviewing these ideas, and especially the third level where my emotions come in line with these ideas, each stage brings me closer to God. And each stage brings it possible, a more probability of God listening to my prayers. So therefore, they're all interconnected. Between the praising of God and the asking of God, because it's only by you getting closer to God will God even listen to your prayer. So the thing is that there's a direct ratio in the God listening to you and your relationship to God, and tefillah, prayer, is a means of getting close to God. But there's two steps of getting close to God. Don't underestimate the knowledge of God. The knowledge of God is also getting close to God. Just the knowledge by itself. Okay? The problem by reviewing, by going over the exact words of the prayer, right? And the mind connecting with the idea, that idea is difficult, right? Because in other words, like it's just like you might get a, like you wanted to say, like it just like rings a bell and the idea pops in, then you move on. Right. But you really didn't really think about it. And yeah, that is true. That is true. At the beginning, it does happen. In other words, when just like when you started to learn, let's say, how to read, you know, like at the beginning, it was very, very difficult. You read a thing, and then you read it again, and then you forgot a word, and then you got it, until it becomes a second nature. This has to become a second nature, and it's a slow process. I would say the best way to do it is, first of all, review with somebody these ideas, to talk it over every day, to talk over the ideas every day so that it is reviewed, and then to constantly try to think about, even though at the beginning it's very mechanical that you just, like, plug it in, you know, that idea without really a thought, without really a fact. I think that in time it can come to that. It's a certain training. I don't know if I could define clearly, you know what I mean, how it, but there are different stages, and you must do it until at a certain point, like suddenly when you say the words and the ideas, like it's a clear idea, you know what I mean? And that's all you have to have is that clear idea. But that takes time. Verse 3, it says, God is great and extremely praiseworthy. And to his greatness, there is no investigation. Well, you can't investigate. Ibn Ezra says that God is great and he is extremely praiseworthy. It means by extremely praiseworthy, he is greater than anything you could praise. He is greater than the praise of the praiser. In other words, it is impossible for a human being to know everything about God. Anything that you know about God, by definition, is less than what God is. So therefore, you have to know that you are not saying what God's greatness is. I mean, we're like a child trying to express Einstein's greatness and say, wow, he could do long division of fractions. Right? I mean, for a child, I mean, it's very nice, but by definition, objectively, it's insulting to Einstein. Right? Because he could definitely do much more. Now, the same thing is that we cannot know God's greatness, what he can do. We are only what we see that we know. But we don't know beyond that. I mean, it's impossible for us to know. So we have to know that anything we say about God is only that, is by definition less than what he is, and that we only have a license to do this only for our benefit, because you really don't know who, you know, how great God is. So therefore, with the reason why we can't say these things is only for our benefit. That what we, I mean, by understanding what we can know of God, that's the way we get close to God. So therefore, we have the right to say it only as a benefit to us. That we don't know what God can do except what we see. Beyond that, we don't know. We don't know anything about God. We don't know what he can do. He could do beyond, we can't even imagine. It's way beyond what even we could imagine. So therefore, anything that we see or know about God is simply less than what he is. Something of God, you have to understand that whatever you know of God is less than what he is. That's what you must know. That idea is very important. There is to know everything that you desire to feel, that I know who God is. I'm intimate with God. I'm friendly with God, you see. Certain intimacy, that I'm close to God. And the thing is, as a child, yes, but at a certain point, you have to start realizing God's greatness, to start realizing, no, you can't be on an intimate level with God. You have to know how to relate to God. That's the purpose of the knowledge of God, and that's the purpose of all the prayers, teach us how to relate to God. This is why we shouldn't write our own prayers, and this is why our sages put down the prayers, because they were the scientists in this area. And so therefore they made sure they put down the correct ideas, make sure that all the ideas were correct. Is if you know, Ed, the question is that if I know all the prayers, so then the question is, so then I do know God. Because all the prayers say everything about God. Yeah, but there's beyond which human beings could understand about God. That's what you have to understand. that God is so far from the human being that it's impossible for the human being to know God. You can only know God how he relates to you personally, but you cannot know him beyond that. Beyond your personal knowledge of God, beyond that, you cannot know him. And then by you, I mean the human species, the human being, beyond that. So therefore, there's a point where you just can't know. Dalit says, from generation to generation, we appraise your works and your strength, and your strengths they tell. The question is, what is the pasuk talking about? The fourth verse, and that is that the greatness of God is received by the multiple, by the more we know about God's actions. And since every generation passes on the information from the last generation, in other words, we have the stories of Bereshit, what happened to Avram, what happened to Yitzhak, what happened to Yaakov, right? Then we have the story of the plagues, what happened in the generation of the plagues, in the generation, then all the miracles that happened in the generation of the desert, the 40 years in the desert, and then the miracles that happened in going into to Eretz Yisrael, and then all the then while we're living in the land, all these things, as we add them up, it becomes more and more. So therefore, his greatness, his praise becomes greater, and that which we know of his praise becomes much greater than I could get in any one generation. It's not what I could say, but it's what's been passed down through all the generations that gives the greatness of his. That tells the greatness of his. It makes it greater. His greatness becomes greater. What we're saying is the quantity of the miracles, or the quantity of his personal relationship to us, that is what makes it great. That's the Dar L'Dar. That's what's passed on. The quantity of stories that the people tell about him. That's what Dar L'Dar means. Is that God becomes great in the world through the stories that people pass on from generation to generation. That's it. This comes from the recognition of people of what he does. Yes. Okay. Success Hadar Kavod Hodecha. I mean, I don't know a good translation for it. But the Ibn Ezra explains it to mean the essence of his honor, of your greatness. In other words, what is the nature of your greatness? You see, that's Hadar Kavod Hodecha, the nature of your greatness. And v'divrei niflosecha asicha. See, here it's Asicha, it's David HaMelech, I speak about the word, the things, the wonders. I speak about your wonders. Now, when I speak, David HaMelech is saying, King David is saying that when I speak about your wonders, then I'm talking about the nature of the way you relate. See, the generation to generation is the public. So the public, they only see what they see with their five senses, you see. So what they see with their five senses, they see they just see the miracles, the great things that God does in every generation. They write that down, they pass it down, and it becomes a quantity of actions of greatness from the creation of the world down to modern times, where we see things that are happening. But however, King David, he looks at not that, but he looks at the nature of it, how it works and why it works. How it works, you see, that's a little different. That, he says, that I speak about in my heart. You see, the Ibn Ezra adds. In other words, this is what I think about. You see, he understands the nature of God. But he understands more insofar as the analysis of all these things and how it works. And we'll see a little bit more. He will explain a little bit more how it works. That we'll see a little bit later. Verse 4 is dealing about the public view of God. Namely, they view God only through the miracles, the physical activities which they either see or hear about. While King David, when he looks at these things and he looks at God, he understands the nature of how it works. Not the nature of God, that we can never know, but in how it works, these particular things. And the details we'll soon see as we go on, okay? Verse 6. And the strength of your awesomeness they speak about, and your greatness I tell. You see, now, the thing is, over here, the difference is they tell and what I tell. He says, they tell about the stories and the greatness of all the things that you've done. But I, on the other hand, I try to explain to them these ideas, maybe, according to the words of the Ibn Ezra, maybe they'll understand. Maybe the public will understand. He tries. The verse 6 is divided into two parts. One is what they say, the public, and one is what I say, King David. Okay? It says what the public talks about is the physical acts, which they see. And I try to tell them the true understanding behind it, so that they should truly understand the ideas. I tried to explain it to them. Okay? Clear? Six is simply saying that the public looks at the world from the physical point of view. So they talk about the wonders of the 10 plagues, the crossing of the Red Sea, what he did in the desert, the miracles that he performed in coming into Israel. Okay? That's what they talk about. But the nature of how God operates is, right? The nature of how God operates, the understanding of it, you see, that King David understands. And he's trying, he says, I'll try to explain it to them. That's what I tell them. The last three psukim, the summary of the last three psukim are like this. They look at the acts, the general acts. King David looks at the ideas, okay? Then he said, they look at the acts, not as a summary of the previous verse, that they look at the acts, but in only in relation that they look at the acts, and I try to explain to them. I try to explain to them how it works, the nature of it. It's not talking about the original verse. What I'd like to ask is, why did he divide I think about it in verse 5, where he says, I think about it, or sicha, means I think about it, and then asaprena, I'll tell others. I mean, why don't he either think about it or let him tell others? If he tells, let's put it this way, why don't he say, I tell others the ideas? Why do you break it down into two distinct steps? One step is, I understand that you have to think about it before you tell, but I mean, that's not necessary for the verse to tell me that. It's enough if the verse tells me that he tells the ideas which he thought about. Could have put it in one statement. Why do you break it into two statements? Okay? One is like this. I think there's two different things here. Sicha is knowledge of the idea until it's totally clear to the person that's thinking about it. But then how to convey and how much to convey, that has to be thought out. It's a different thing. It's a different process. There's the process of thinking, and then there's two steps in giving it over. One is how to give it over, and two is how much to give over. Maybe you're not ready for all the ideas. So therefore, there must be that there's two separate things here. There's first you must gain the knowledge, it must be thorough and clear in your mind. But then if you want to give it over, there must be two things. There must be a method of giving it over, and two, how much you should give over. Okay? Verse 7. The recollection of your great goodness they will talk about, and your righteousness they will praise. Okay? The thing is, I think this verse is introducing a turning point. According to Rashi, this goes back that they should pass it on. It's as if it's repeating it. But in other words, they tell us great goodness and they tell you righteousness, right? Okay?
Right.
Now, so the thing is like this. So let's see the order, just a quick summary of what we have so far. What we have so far is that the purpose of prayer is to get your emotions in line with your ideas. Okay? So that's the first thing he says. That's verse 1 and 2. Verse 3 tells us that God is way beyond anything we could understand. Okay? So therefore, whatever you say about God is less than what it is. Okay? That's like setting it up. Number 4, verse 4, 5, and 6 is saying that how we get the information. Either we get it through physical acts of God or through the ideas. But so far we haven't spoken about God's ideas himself. This is all by way of introduction of how it's passed on and how we get it. But now he's saying, what is the praise? We talk about God's goodness, abundant goodness, and his righteousness. That is the introduction to the next verse, which starts where we start talking about God himself. The verse 7 is only an introduction to the rest of the parak. Okay? The rest of the chapter. As merciful as God, anger and great kindness.
Great and kindness.
Great and kindness. Okay. What are the four qualities of God? I'll explain that these four components. It's really not qualities of God, because since we cannot know anything about God, we can't be talking about qualities of God. So therefore, these are four ways in way God relates to us. Okay. The first one is graciousness. It means that he supplies every creature with their needs. Okay? Like, for instance, most animals need air, so everybody has air, right? They need food, they have food. Fish need water, they have water. All their needs, right? What they need, God has satisfied all the needs, all the basic needs of existence for every creature. That's God. For mercy, that God has mercy means that God has created a means of you protecting yourself against your enemies. Every species has the means of protecting themselves against their enemies, not in so far as the individual. There's always, like, for instance, there are certain species that eat other species. Now, so therefore, there's certain particulars that will be eaten, right? But however, the species will be saved as a whole. God has created a means of either by certain species that are eaten by others. He made such a quantity that how much you eat is going to be more. But within the system, there's a system, the first system of Hanun, right, of graciousness, that system is is so that you should exist. It satisfy all the needs that your natural thing should, you should exist. Then there are things in the physical world that destroy certain species. So therefore, he created within that species a means of prevention against its destruction by the natural enemies, whether it be disease or other animals or whatever it may be. He created within the species that they should be able to protect themselves. Four qualities of God that we're talking about, I got from the Radak. Okay, it's his interpretation. First two attributes of God deal with all species of animals, including the humans. This is already in particular for the human being. And that is that the human being was given free will. And therefore, the human being can do activities which can harm himself. Now, insofar as the laws of nature is concerned, people could do things that are harmful to themselves but they don't get the consequences for many years. That's what it means, long to anger. I'm not talking about where God intervenes in the destruction, like Sodom, where he brought down fire and brimstone, and went different places where he held off, where he could have done it earlier, but he held off. I'm not talking about that. I'm just showing only within the laws of nature, that the very laws of nature was created by God, and that our very prayers are really describing how God created the laws of nature. And you see that most times, I mean, most kids are very do foolish things because they don't know what is right and what is wrong. And yet, somehow, they make it through. Certain people like smoking. I mean, definitely if a person smokes a pack a day for 5 years, I mean, probably, you know, well, nothing will happen if he quits then. And his ways that are not in line with reality, and he really harms himself. You see that God gives them the chance to change their ways and to train themselves in line with the best possible life, namely the Torah life. It means he's not going to punish you right away. That's what's slow to anger. He's not going to punish you. You're not going to get the consequences of your actions right away. And that you see in the laws of nature. And most times in the laws of nature, people do bad things to themselves and to their bodies, and yet they last for long times before they get the consequences. As God relates to us in good and evil, when we don't keep the commandments, it works the same way. In other words, it's the same thing, that God doesn't punish us right away, and he punishes us later. But I am only showing you these things within the laws of nature so that you could see these ideas in your everyday life. It's happening to you. But of course, these very ideas is definitely going to work where God relates to us personally based on our actions of good and evil, like he punishes and rewards the righteous on a very close level. But I'm saying that these qualities of that how God relates to us, these components of the way God relates to us, that God also does it in the laws of nature, not only in his personal relationship to us, but also in his very laws of nature. He created the laws of nature according to these ways. These are not qualities of God. We cannot know God. This is the way God relates to us. So all I'm doing is showing you how God relates to us. I'm showing you how it works in the laws of nature, and I'm showing you how it works on the other end. That's the study of Torah, where you see that God in his personal way punishes the Jews when they do wrong, or he punishes the enemies, or whatever, whichever way it is. You see? So the thing is that definitely you see that he doesn't do it right away. Okay? But I'm also trying to show you that this system also works within the laws of nature, too. The question that's being asked is like this. According to what we're saying, that the world, in other words, like for instance smoking, we're saying that smoking is wrong, and therefore really we deserve immediate punishment. But however, God is merciful and doesn't punish us right away. Okay? Maybe this is just simply the laws of nature, and that's the way the laws of nature, how do you know this has to do with God's mercy? Is that the question? Do you know any other species that goes out of its way to harm itself besides the human being? Well, you're saying that the human being really does things to harm itself. Is that correct? Which is wrong, and therefore such a species should not exist really, because the thing is right. Because is harming yourself intrinsically evil? Is harming yourself an evil? And so therefore, if it's an evil, so then smoking that much that will harm your body, so then it is an evil.
Sure.
So it's wrong. God is long to anger means I'm saying that the way he relates to us, that fits into the laws of nature, and it fits into God's personal relationship to us, where God relates to us personally on a closer level than just the laws of nature. The stories that you'll find in Torah is God's personal relationship to us. And there you will see also the same idea that God does not punish us right away, but he is long to anger. But I'm also saying that that quality of God, the way God relates to us, that is long to anger, is also within the laws of nature, so you could see it around you every minute that that component is there. Because you do a lot of things that harm yourself, and yet you don't get the immediate punishment. God created that quality within the laws of nature. And he gives you time to undo the evil, the problem that you've caused yourself. He gives you time to undo it, and if you don't undo it, so then you'll get at a certain point, you will get the consequences. Evil means our natural enemies, like in the laws of nature, like for instance by the animal. That's also by the animal kingdom, mercy. Like for instance, like there's certain animals that have particular, hold on. There's certain animals that have particular, enemies. They have enemies. We have diseases. We have different things. And yet we have an immune system within us to protect us from these things. You say certain animals have certain protective things that they protect themselves against animals, other animals that are out to get them. That is rachum, to prevent the destruction of the species. But erech ha'payim is only for the human being, because the human being can do, because of free will, the human being can do things which are harmful to itself. Doing sin, meaning it means doing harm to yourself. Like smoking, that's doing harm to yourself. Now, it is a certain amount of time that you won't get the destruction of smoking. And if you undo it, they say the body could cure all the problems that it caused. You see? But that's only if you get it at a certain time. If you go beyond, then you're going to get the consequences of smoking. That's what it means that that he's long to anger. And the natural harmful things that are natural within the world, not what you do to yourself. It's natural harmful things that, for instance, certain animals kill, like tigers, they go hunting for deer. Now, deer have speed and they have different ways of maneuvering. You see? And to get away from the lion. So therefore, you know, most of the deer do get away from the lion. The lion that catches the deer, I mean, it's not every time that the lion goes after the deer, it's going to get him. So therefore, the thing is, God created within them to protect themselves from their natural enemies. And we naturally, there's natural diseases in the world, we have a certain immune system that we can protect ourselves. That's simply a natural thing. If God didn't protect us, God didn't create, through mercy, the natural ways of protecting ourselves, that species would be dead, because every species has enemies, has things that will destroy them. And if it doesn't have protection against outside things that could harm it, so then the species would be destroyed. But however, when it says that God takes long to anger, that means only by a human being. Anger is when you do something wrong. See, mercy is not when you do something wrong. He created something that you have certain weaknesses that could do, from the outside world that could destroy you, and he protected you naturally. But here's where you have the choice to do right, to harm yourself or not to harm yourself. You have to be very, very careful. These terms that we use here, like God is merciful and God is long to anger, we put it in our own terms and we have wrong, incorrect terms. And we keep going back to these wrong, incorrect ways, the way we look at God. I'm saying that God works, relates to us through a certain system. And it's a personal system, the way he relates to us, and it is the laws of nature. But he created the laws of nature. There's a medrash that says that when God wanted to create the world, he looked in the Torah. In other words, the physical world was created by these ideas. It's not like there's two separate things. There's the laws of nature, like an evil thing, and then God comes in. Like there's two different powers, good and evil. There's no two powers here. There is only one thing. There is God's, the way God relates to us. And when he created the physical world, he created it according to these components, these attributes and the way he relates to us. It's not, that's all it is. It's not more than that. Let's say, for instance, a person gets a punishment. In other words, a consequence of one of his actions. How is he going to be able to tell, since it's 5-10 years later, how could he tell that it's a result of that act? Right? The answer is that when a person is a child, you have to punish them immediately because they can't think longer than the immediate. But however, at a certain point where the mind is developed, like you're starting with around teenagers, the teenagers, their minds are developed enough that you could show them the consequences, and that becomes a training of Torah. That's all the ethics of Torah. All the ethics of Torah is based on the consequences of your act, of evaluating the pleasure of the act versus the consequences that could come to it. If the consequences are greater than the pleasure, then don't take it. If the pleasure is greater than the consequence, or is very little consequence, so then the pleasure is worth it. Or vice versa, if the pain, like shots, right? Now, if the pain is so great that it's not worth the consequences, like getting cancer or some other disease, so, I mean, that'd be crazy, you know what I mean? So therefore, it's worth the pain now to avoid that consequence. Now, we have to be trained to think that way. Well, that means that we're training to think according to the laws of nature, which is really the idea of Erech HaPayim, that God gives, because it takes years of training to be able to live this way, so God had to create within the human that he shouldn't die right away, and he shouldn't be punished for his actions, but the consequences take a certain amount of time so that he could work through and start training himself and undoing the evil. You see? So therefore, there's a direct relationship between God creating the longevity of the consequences before you get the consequence to the time for a person to be able to undo the causes that will bring to that consequence. Everything that happens to you, is that a consequence of what you did? The answer is no. The answer is no. Say that most of your actions, yes. Most, I would say, is usually a consequence of some incorrect act that you did, some incorrect way that you lived. Most of them. But not all. Not all. There are things that happen that have nothing to do with you. Words like this. God is very... Sometimes, God will, like, for instance, like Sodom, he brought fire and brimstone upon the nation. So he did it in a spectacular way for a particular purpose. You have to understand why he did it in a spectacular way. Okay? But most of the times... when things happen to you, it's a consequence. It's not done in a spectacular way. It's done as a result of a consequence. Okay? Now, many times when you come across God punishes, God is going to punish you, it's basically a consequence of your actions, and you have to see the natural consequences of how one thing leads to another. Study of ethics. That's the study of ethics in Torah. Person will not succeed. Hidden illustration. Not so. Not what your parents always have been telling you. A different type of illustration. Means that you really. It's very, very hard. As you go through the science, you see it more and more. How your emotions causes you to do actions, incorrect actions throughout your life, where you suffer the consequences. There's a certain way of viewing life. You view life from a certain point of view. And as a result of that view, I'll give you an illustration. Let's take jealousy, okay? Jealousy is that you do not... The philosophy of jealousy is you do not deserve to have these things. I do. You do. Right? Now, to make sure this philosophy comes true, so I go and kill myself and dry myself to beat out the Joneses. So therefore, my whole life I'm driven by beating out the Joneses only because I have an incorrect view, an incorrect philosophy of life. Namely, you don't deserve to have it, but I do. So to make sure that I have more than you, so then I go out and kill myself. And the consequences for that incorrect view of life. The system of ethics is really based on this idea that we can't correct ourselves. We have a wrong view of the world around us, and through the study of the
Torah,
changed our false view into correct views, and then we start living. We don't correct this or that. I mean, we have to correct this or that particular act. But however, the basic thing is changing our total view, our false view of reality, into a correct view of reality. That's our whole ethics. Now, therefore, God has Erech HaPayim. He gives us time to do that. Instead of going into the laws of nature, somebody's going into laws, Jewish laws. Right, the laws that God gave us, okay? Let's say, for instance, a person doesn't put on phylacteries, okay? So what is the consequence of not putting on phylacteries? In his introduction to the ethics of the fathers, he says that the real problem with sin is like this. See, let's say, for instance, I have a wrong view of life. And then I do an act according to that wrong view. Now, every time I do an act according to that wrong view, it strengthens the view even more. So every time, by strengthening the view, it means it broadens out my incorrect view to all areas. It becomes more part of me, the incorrect view. Okay? Now, putting on phylacteries is not a particular thing. See, we don't look at the laws that I just keep this law, not that law. We keep the laws because we have knowledge that there is a God and that God gave us the system. That becomes a reality. Now, if for any reason I don't live according to this reality, so then what I'm saying, within my very soul is that I do not go along with this philosophy. And every time I do not do it, I'm going further away from reality. You see? So therefore, the whole thing is, it's not this or that act, but it's the whole, your whole relation. See, free will is not free will in this or that act. Free will is, who are you? Are you a person that lives according to a false view of reality? Or are you a person that only lives totally in line with reality? You see? And therefore, when you go according to the false ideas, it's changing your whole being and making you into something that is totally looks at the world incorrectly. You must get worse. You're not static. You're constantly changing. And if you're involved in the world of ideas, then you're constantly moving towards the world of reality and more, and you see more of reality and you relate more to reality. You see? So there's less chance of making mistakes. So when you ask me a question, what if I don't put on phylacteries? The consequences are that you're moving away from reality. And you're giving more into the emotions and the fantasies that relate to the physical world, you see? And therefore, we're talking about your very soul, how you look at life, who you are, you see? Your very view of life.
Nothing is physical.
The question is that my saying, is there physical harm? I say the further you go away from reality, the further, the easier it is for you to make mistakes and greater mistakes. I say that's what the problem is. In other words, sometimes the consequence is that I do an act now that I get the results later. Sometimes I do an act now that affects my soul and how, therefore I could do acts later which I never would have thought of doing now. A criminal does not start out with murder. He starts out by stealing something small. And then a little bigger, and a little bigger, you see? And then at a certain point, he could do physical harm. First he does harm only in the objects. Then he could start doing physical harm, then he can murder. You see? So therefore, that's a development to be able to go from stealing a stamp to murder. You see? Rashi says, what is the nature of the evil inclination? He says, today he tells you to do this. Tamari tells you to do that until you can worship idols. Question is, if we're talking about a person sitting and studying Torah day and night, how is it possible that this guy's going to worship idols? I mean, that's going too far. The answer is no, it's not going too far. Because, let's say, for instance, you study Torah 10 hours a day, and then suddenly you study Torah 8 hours a day. For no reason, not because of any practical reason. So before you were defined as a 10-hour person, now you're defined as an 8-hour person. That's what Rabbeinu Yonah says, if you do an act 2-3 times, it becomes part of your nature. So now I'm an 8-hour person. Now it's not so difficult. It might have been difficult for going to 10 hours to 5 hours, but going from 8 hours to 5 hours is not so difficult. Now, I'm just showing you in the quantity. Now, let's say you give up this commandment or that commandment. Slowly but surely, you could go totally the opposite direction. Certain people that take care of the health very much, right? But otherwise, they don't live a rational life, right? And therefore, let's say, for instance, they have conflicts. Conflicts shorten your life. You make decisions that are going to harm you. There are people that work and drive themselves and kill themselves. They could eat all the healthy food in the world, and they're still killing themselves for other reasons. They put themselves in situations that are harmful without thinking about it, because they're not trained to think about these things. I mean, it's not just... It's amazing. We have to look at the broad... In other words, we're talking about the total person. Once you start living irrationally in one area, and if you allow it to develop, it keeps getting worse. And either it could get worse in that one particular area, or it could get worse that it goes into other areas. And sooner or later, it's going to affect you. Help you undo your conflicts. The Torah itself will help you undo your conflicts. It'll stop you being driven to whatever people are driven for greed or for whatever, for pleasures, for whatever they're driven for. These things drive people, it destroys them. The conflict itself affects them. And two is that their actions are affected by these conflicts and by these drives and by these fantasies. It's affected, so therefore, sooner or later, they're going to do harm to themselves. They will suffer the consequences. You advance in the world of evil, you also advance in the world of good. And advancement in the world of good comes through the world of knowledge and study and ideas. The sages put it this way, that there's the short, long road, and there's the long, short road. The short, long means that it's easier at the beginning. That's following the life of your desires and pleasures, but then it's hard later because then you have all the consequences of all your actions. Then there's the hard, short road, the long road is the life of Torah, because when you start sitting down to study Torah, it goes contrary to all your desires. Teenager wants to go out and enjoy life and have the pleasures and the dances and all these things, and we're saying, no, sit down and spend your time and study and lower these pleasures. So it's much harder, it's a much longer road. But in the end, if you follow that road, then you'll get all the benefits of the living the Torah life. The next one is greatness in kindness, great kindness. A lot of kindness, okay? The question is, what does it mean, okay? Right, the thing is, you'll see by the human being always has more than what they need. You have enough to put in the bank. You have enough, you have way beyond that's going to last your lifetime. You have what to give over to inheritance for the next generation. You say, God has given to the human being a bounty much beyond which his basic needs are. He gives not only way beyond your luxuries. I mean, you have money to put in the bank, and you know what I mean? There's a lot. So therefore, God has given to the human being with greater abundance than he's given any other species. Every other species gets enough for its existence and to protect itself. The first two components that we spoke about. But however, Gadol Chesed is something special for the human, that he's given more to the human than their needs are. Verse 10, God is good to all, and his mercy is on all his works. We said that that this psalm is dealing with God the King. Okay? Now the king, the last verse tells us that basically the definition of a king, according to the last verse, would be that he takes care of the needs of his subjects. Okay? Now, the thing is that the difference between God the King and a regular king is he can't take care of all his subjects. You see? But God takes care of every one of his subjects. All subjects are taken care of, and he has mercy on all of them. How does God take care of all his creatures? This is that since he created it within the laws of nature, like we showed last week, all his attributes and all the way he relates to us, in every way is part of the laws of nature. So the laws of nature affect everything in the all creatures in the planet. So therefore, in that way, he would take care of every single creature. But however, a king cannot do that. Nature takes care of all our needs and protects us from all our enemies and gives us time to undo our faults as humans. And since we have an abundance of more than we need so that we could be involved in the world of Torah and study of Torah, so therefore all needs are taken care of. And since in the laws of nature, it affects everybody that way. Now the question is, where is it talking about a king over here? According to the Ibn Ezra said that this whole chapter is talking about a king, and it starts at the beginning of the verse 1, okay, where it says, my God the King. So he says that's the introduction, and he says the whole thing is dealing with the king. Basically, his definition of a king is a king has to take care of the needs of the subjects. Now, the last verse we showed exactly how he takes care of the subjects. Now we're saying how God takes care of the subjects of all his creatures. He takes care of all of them, while a regular king can't take care of all the subjects, and he can't have mercy. Definitely can't have mercy on all the subjects. But however, God the King can, because God can do it. He does it via the laws of nature, and therefore it's inherent in the laws of nature. All these attributes that we just mentioned. The purpose of verse 8 was to tell us the attributes. Here it says how far-reaching the attributes are. The idea of learning, where it says that God has great kindness, and we said that the humans have more. They have more than they need. They have in the bank, and they could save, and they put away. They have extra crops, more than they need. And the question is, why did God do this? What I'm saying is a possibility. And yes, he really said it the other time, and that is that for the purpose that the people should be able to study Torah. So if they have the extra money and the extra whatever is necessary they need, so therefore they'll have time to learn, and they won't have to take care of their needs constantly. Like the animals, they're constantly involved with taking care of their needs. You see, but a human can work it out that his needs can be lowered. Not that his needs can be lowered, that he'll have enough income that'll be able to work less. He'll be able to work it out, so he should be able to put his time into the world of study. All your works will thank you, Hashem, thank you, God, and your chassid, your righteous, will bless you. All your works, he seems to, in my mind, it seems to apply to all creatures. So the question is, how do they thank God? You know what I mean? How do all creatures thank God?
Even if you want to translate the word Yoducha as acknowledge, the problem is still
the same. All the creatures do not acknowledge God. They don't have the ability. Only the human has the ability to acknowledge God. Still comes out the same question. How do the creatures acknowledge God? You're still going to have to put it somehow, work it out here.
The truth is that only the
human like this is really that the Yossi wants to say that really the creatures do not praise. They cannot praise, but they act in such a way that when the human recognizes it, he acknowledges God. Because when he acknowledges God in the system, like for instance, there's a pasuk in Mishlei about the wisdom of the animals. And the Ibn Ezra immediately says, it's not the wisdom of the animals, it's really the wisdom of the God. You see? It's the wisdom of the Creator. See, they only do it instinctually. You see? So therefore, we could acknowledge God when we acknowledge the system of all his creations and how they work. And how they interact even with each other and how they work within each other. All these things that we said about Chanun Verachum, so that's a means of recognition of wow, saying, wow, that's something special. Then V'Chesidecha Yivarchucha is just a further development of the same thing, a higher level of the of that. Okay? Basically, the verse is saying that the humans recognize, that's true, the humans recognize, but the humans can recognize it really through the existence of the human, right? By answering all, there are questions about God's justice on the human. I understand all the questions, but when you work through all these questions and all these things and you see it clearly, and then also you see it through the world of the animal, and through the world of the rest, and it says on all of them, it means the trees, the growing things, and living things, and all these things, you see how the whole system works, you see, then it is the human that acknowledges God. It must be the human when he sees all these works. How does it fit into the verse? Because the verse does say that all your creatures acknowledge you, right? The answer is that many times it's a style of writing that they had. And they would say the object that really, which via that object you would praise God or recognize God. So they say that object recognizes. But it was a style of writing, like I mentioned before, in the Proverbs where it says that the four animals that are very weak and very wise, you know, and then it goes on to explain how they're wise. And the Ibn Ezra on the spot says that it's not there, they're not wise. It shows the wisdom of God. It was Proverbs chapter 30, verse 24. 11. The honor of your kingship they will speak, and your glorious strength they will speak. Clear. And that kavod means a certain ideas of God. Certain ideas. In other words, the public, we said, public looks at God, and the greatness of God is through his miracles, through the obvious, through the physical things. So they see his greatness. While King David says, while he looks at God, and he sees the ideas and the discussions that we're having here now, these ideas that we're discussing now, so we start getting in, that's the kavod. That's the kavod of God. So it says that, the Ibn Ezra says that verse 11 follows, and your chassidim, your righteous, will bless you. How will they bless you? They'll bless you through kavod malchuscha, through the honor of your kingdom. In other words, that's the ideas. They'll bless you. Now, bless doesn't mean like I'll give you something. It means to recognize, to accept, to recognize God, and or to praise God, through via the ideas that you understand how God relates to us. That strength is through the physical. In other words, through the miracles and things, that shows God's strength. 12, to make known to the people his strength and the honor of his glorious kingdom. The last verse also says, now after they recognize, verse 11 says that they bless God through certain recognition of God, then lahodia, they make it known. You see, then they make it known whatever is possible for the people that don't know these ideas. They make known these two things. They try and show the public these two things, the people that don't recognize these things. So then they try and make it known to the public. verse 13 is your kingdom is the kingdom forever, and your rulership is in every generation. In comparison to other kings that their kingdom stops, you know, either the kingdom fails or they die. So either way, they don't have control over the kingdom. But however, by God in his kingdom, he has constant control over it at all times. It never stops. Verse 14, God supports all that have fallen and raises all that are bent. The question is like this, that we know if God intervenes, definitely God will raise anybody that has fallen. By fallen, it means either poor person or person, a slave or whatever, somebody downtrodden. But the question is, can this work also within the laws of nature? This principle that God helps the downtrodden is within the laws of nature. He put it within the laws of nature. Can we see it there? This is, we could understand with God's personal intervention or his personal relationship to you that God could lift the downtrodden. If a person is a righteous person, he'll lift them. But can we see within the laws of nature, is it possible to see within the laws of nature that God has placed within the laws of nature that he will help the downtrodden, he will lift up the downtrodden? In two systems, okay? One system is the laws of nature, and there is another system which is a closer relationship to the human being. The difference, the way it works, is that the laws of nature do not know you. They have no idea who you are. If you go fall in a tide, the tide will pull you out. The tide doesn't know you. If a tiger eats you or a shark eats you, he doesn't know you. It's not a personal thing. Okay? However, Hashgacha Pratius is God's personal relationship is where the laws of nature relate to you because of your perfection and because of your closeness to God. So the laws of nature somehow, I can't tell you the way it works, but that somehow it relates directly to your soul. In other words, the physical changes for your needs if you are on the level. Okay? It's a system that must happen. It's not a miracle. Miracle is a third way of God relates, where he actually suspends the laws of nature. But here, somehow, the laws of nature are redirected. In other words, if a hungry lion is coming towards a tzaddik, it could be that the hashkacha would, that a deer that naturally wouldn't go there would go in front of the lion so it would protect the tzaddik. So somehow, it doesn't suspend the laws, but it somehow redirects them in the favor of the righteous. Okay? But however, we live in two worlds. We also live in a world of laws of nature. And so therefore, you have to see how to live within the laws of nature too. That's why we have such a book as Mishlei to help us with that system. Okay? So the thing is that it's saying that according to this tefillah, I could understand if a person is on the level. So then God is close to them and God will help them if they're downtrodden. But however, insofar as the laws of nature, does it work within the laws of nature? Definitely downtrodden physically. Okay? Whether your soul is downtrodden or not, that we're not discussing. Just if you're physically downtrodden, somehow God will help you. That's what we want to understand now. There is a proverb in Mishlei. It's Perek, chapter 17, verse 2. And it says that a slave that is intelligent will rule over an embarrassing son, and among his brothers he will divide his inheritance. It reads, Eved maskil yimshol b'ven mevish uv'soch achim yachalok nachala. an embarrassing son, it means that a person that doesn't fight is an embarrassment to his parents. That's what an embarrassing son. Basically, he's a failure. Okay? Now, therefore, a slave that has intelligence will definitely be able to control, through his wisdom, be able to control this rich master, the son. Not the father who made the wealth, but the son that doesn't know how to, that's not wise, he doesn't know how to deal with it. And not only that, it'll come out that the slave will be among the brothers of the father, among the brothers of the foolish son. He will take his place, and he will divide the inheritance and take the place. Okay? Because we see that wisdom, knowledge, what knowledge does is that it makes you successful and beat out people, even though they might have wealth or power. A little planning and a little strategy many times could beat out the strongest and wealthiest. I'd like to analyze an American proverb. It says that necessity is the mother of invention. Is that when you're in trouble, so then you start thinking of ways and working things out to pull yourself naturally out of trouble. Okay? I agree that these proverbs are not 100%. Certain people will just melt under adversity. But however, if there's going to be any type of thought, what's going to bring it out in a person is going to be a necessity. Where he's really under the gun, that forces him to take steps to do something. You find that by Taro also. He says, come let us wisen up unto them. In other words, that was the children of Israel. So when did they start thinking? When they start thinking of becoming wise? Only when it was a practical thing. But they weren't involved in the world of wisdom. They didn't think in terms of wisdom. They just got involved in the world of wisdom when it was a practical thing, when there was necessity. So people work out the cause of a lot of strategies and plans and new things comes basically when there's a necessity. Like, for instance, I'll give you an interesting illustration. They say, how did the karate, the hand to be able to break things come? Of course, the Chinese were very, very poor. They couldn't have any weapons. And the military of the Chinese in those days wore wooden armor. So therefore, they trained themselves, they worked it out to make their hands a weapon to break wood. And that was the only way they could fight the police there. They say one of the judo or one of those type of martial arts was made by a 90-pound weakling that everybody used to start up and beat him up. And so therefore he worked it out how through certain martial arts he could win the fight. So you see that it's true that not everybody could think of it, not everybody is that wise, but you see that necessity forces you into thinking, okay? I think what happens in general, if you look around, and that is that, let's say, for instance, a person wants to become wealthy. He's a poor person, and he uses wisdom, and without realizing, he still has certain plans and certain strategies, even without going to a school and training you how to think. But naturally, like we said, that necessity becomes the mother of invention. They start working out plans, how to sell and how to do things, right? But however, the object of what they really hold as power and strength is the money. Or for instance, if you hold power is the security. So you use knowledge to get that power, but you really hold power is your security, or money becomes your security. Whatever it may be, or being accepted by society is your security, whatever it may be. So you use your mind to get there. But so therefore, when you raise your child, what we're talking about in the embarrassing son, it's very possible an embarrassing son could come about because he's raised that not thinking makes you successful. But the object of what, like the money
or the power or society or family, whatever you think is security, becomes the essence of your security. So therefore they become downtrodden, you see, and the downtrodden then have to start thinking, you see. But the thing is, the only one out of this all is really a person that raises his child according to Torah. Because if he's raised according to Torah, then he's raised according that the only thing that guides you and makes you successful in anything is through thought. Even the way we learned this parak, we see this chapter, that even reaching God, you need wisdom even in reaching God. Without wisdom, there can't be any success. And all these other things cannot help you be successful. They are good to have. I'm not denying they're good to have, but not as a security. These do not give you security. So when you raise your children that these are security, these are the real security,